welcome into another edition of the Indiana Ag Policy Podcast. We're presented by the Indiana Corn Growers Association, the Indiana Soybean Alliance, with support from Indiana Farm Bureau. I'm Eric Pfeiffer, your host, and we come to you today from Hat Studio 2A. Not even my studio. We decided to park it today in Andy Eubank's studio, and we welcome in Kendall Culp, State Representative, District 16, Indiana Farm Bureau Vice President. And you were just kind of making your way through town here on your way from the State House back home to Rensselaer. And Kendall, really appreciate you stopping by and taking time to do this because, man, oh, man, it is a busy time at the State House. And ag bills are everywhere, it seems. You've got, I think I counted, 15 bills that you have authored or co-authored. And the majority of them, I think, one or two maybe don't have to do with agriculture?
Yeah, I think only one.
So again, thank you for making time to do this. This is great that that we can chat through some of these things. And obviously, property taxes. I mean, this is what this session has really kind of been mostly about. It's just taken over the conversation here. And I know that Indiana Farm Bureau has been at the forefront of the conversation. Other groups like Indiana Corn, Indiana Soy, Indiana Pork, I mean, you talk about all the farm organizations have been at the forefront of this. What have all the conversations been like there at the State House as it relates to property taxes?
Well, I think the legislators, by and large, are hearing from their constituents and have for a few years about the concern about the rise in property taxes and their liability when it comes time to pay those tax bills. So there's a lot of momentum moving forward with that. Couple that with a very competitive governor's race, very competitive Republican primary especially, and then general election where both candidates leading up to the fall election last year had property tax proposals, very detailed tax proposals. Sometimes you don't see, you just talk about generalities and the need for tax reform. Here we had some specific suggestions on way to try to curb that increase. Obviously, anytime you talk about property taxes from a political standpoint, or an elected official standpoint, you're going to talk about homeowner taxes, which Governor Braun did as a candidate. But he also did talk about the rise in farmland taxes as well. And so I think he's committed to, if he gives relief to homeowners, he wants to see equal relief to farmland and farmers. And those of us in agriculture are really appreciative of that.
The big part of this plan, if we look at SB1, I mean that's the big overriding thing, the number one priority at the State House. The big thing here is taking things back to 2021. If you listen to him talk about it, pre Biden, pre Kamala, pre inflation. And that is kind of the sweet spot for him in taking things back to where they were. For agriculture, for you in your position as, one, a farmer, two, Indiana Farm Bureau Vice President, and three, a state representative representing the 16th District, obviously it's in the Senate now, but it's going to be coming your way here at some point, I would imagine. What does that do for your constituents and for farmers?
Well, first of all, normally a bill that comprehensive, a tax bill, would begin in the House. So it's a little unusual. We have both bills. So the Senate, like you said, has Senate Bill 1. Representative Thompson, which is chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee, that usually starts the budget, they start the budget talks. He has a very comprehensive bill that goes just beyond property taxes. It's a funding bill. It talks about a lot of lit, about referendums, and it's the whole gamut. And then on top of that, yesterday we heard the governor's budget was released by the governor's office. And so now you have three actually documents out here, two pieces of legislation and the governor's bill, which is, of course, very comprehensive, that has all of his priorities in it. And so in the end, those kind of all get melded together. And legislators don't all have the same approach or the same ideas of how to solve an issue. And so the Senate could be totally different than what the House says. And then, like I said, then you get the governor says, but here's what I think's most important. Here's what I campaigned on. Here's what the voters elected me to do. And so there's some pressure from that standpoint. And like I say, in the end, those kind of come together, but it's those themes of, okay, we need reform, whether it's the base rate of farmland, whether it's the annual increase in property taxes as far as your statement or the levy increases. And you balance that all with local government needs, because that's what funds local governments, property taxes. No property tax dollars go to the state. That's all local: cities, towns, counties, libraries, schools. And so we have to make sure that they're whole and that they can meet the needs of their constituents and provide the services that they do. So there's a lot of different groups coming to the State House with their concerns, their thoughts, their ideas, their suggestions. In the end, though, at the end of April, we will have a tax reform package that we will vote through.
There has to be one, right? I mean, it's got to happen. Let's talk about some of the legislation that you've put forward, starting with 1192, HB 1192. This is a bill that you've put forward that basically it redoes the math on this whole thing, right? It's taking everything that goes into the formula for farmland and how it's assessed, and it redoes the math. Are you a mathematician in addition to a farmer here,
well,
Kendall?
I didn't think so, but I tried to keep it simple with my limited math knowledge, and I can tell you that what I found in the General Assembly is big, comprehensive, complicated bills usually don't pass. And if you've got a big issue, it takes several different bites of the apple over years, different sessions, different pieces of legislation to really get to where you want to be. And so I took that approach this year and introduced House Bill 1192, which makes adjustments to the farmland base rate. So the last 3 years, farmers, property or farmland owners, their assessed value has gone up 62% over the last 3 years,
which is asinine.
To have a 27% increase in 1 year is just really unbelievable. And even when we hear from homeowners, they haven't had anything like that. And so for one thing, it takes somebody to keep reminding other legislators is, while you think your constituents have it bad, look what Indiana agriculture has endured for the last 3 years. And so when you're talking relief, we need to make sure that we keep talking about we need relief too as well. And that's where farmland owners, it's really important for them to be advocates and to let their legislators know that, hey, our property taxes are too high. We need some adjustments made. That message can be that simple, and it's that important. So what mine does, it adjusts two things. So the current formula is really a complex formula that Purdue has come up with, and it takes cash rent values, commodity prices, input cost, and aggregates those together and divides by a capitalization interest rate. Right now, that capitalization interest rate is 8%. So the bigger the number, the bigger the percentage, the smaller your product will be at the end, which is your base rate of your assessed valuation for farmland. So I'm suggesting that goes from 8% to 10%. Last year, the House passed 9%, but the Senate didn't pick it up. So I know we can get to 9% pretty easy. There is a bill on the Senate side to take it to 9% as well. So I'm suggesting to take it to 10. We'll work that out with the Senate when the time comes. The second part, which is a little bit unique, is the other thing we do is we look back 6 years of the past six assessed valuation numbers, and we average those we drop the high year and average the remaining five. And so that gives us a number to come up with the average, and that's what our base rate is. I'm suggesting instead of dropping the one high, we drop the two high. And that's going to lower that rate a little more, but there's a thought behind that. So currently, we are looking back a long time, 6 years. So that's not very reflective of today's agricultural economy. 6 years ago, things were a lot better on the farm than they are now from a price and a financial standpoint.
Almost record high.
Exactly. Yeah. And so we have those high numbers that we're still averaging in. Even though we dropped the high, the next ones are very high as well. So the concern is we try to, the reason you lengthen that out is you take out the high, the peaks and the valleys to try to smooth that rate out. But the further you go back, again, the further we are away from today's actual economics on the farm. And so by putting that together and taking 4 years instead of 5 years, I think we reflect a little closer today's economy, agriculture economy. Now, there's, again, there's a concern with that is we're going back a long ways and you're dropping to, is there a better method? There could be, but that's a pretty easy way to gain a little bit. Dr. DeBoer at Purdue has done some research on that. The change, 1% change the capitalization rate means a lot more relief than what dropping the second high year is. But you put that together, if you look at the chart, Katrina Hall with Farm Bureau has these charts of the corn price chart. And when the corn is high, the agriculture economy, of course, is high. And but then our base rate is, because we're going back so far, is a lot lower. So the difference is immense. Then when crop prices are low, we're going back to those good years and average them in, our assessed value goes up. And so they're, it's totally inverted. And we need to try to get those two graphs to where they're a lot more closer together.
You mentioned, is there a better way? You know, maybe, but has anyone come up with that better way yet? I mean, ideas welcome. I mean, that's kind of your gig, right? Like there at the State House, I don't, you know, there aren't any bad ideas, just come to me with ideas and let's talk it through.
Well,
but
and that's interesting, I mean, you say that, because 1192 was heard in the Committee on Ways and Means, and I had a lot of questions about the formula, and nobody I don't think was opposed to understanding the idea that agriculture needs some relief. But they said, is this a Band-Aid? Is this a short-term fix? Because it seemed like you were here 7 years ago, which is true. And I said, well, no, this isn't a permanent fix. But they said, well, we'd like to see a permanent fix. Well, that's the committee that writes the laws. They're the ones that comes up with the language of what that fix is. And so I don't really believe that there's that big of a willingness on the behalf of the committee to really fix this like we think. It's so much easier when you're at the State House to come up with something that pacifies your constituency, and then you live for another day. And then in a few years, you know you're going to come back again. Honestly, even though this is a long session, there is not enough time to take a blank sheet of paper out and say, let's start over and let's figure this out. Because that's going to take a lot of time, a lot of thought, a lot of study and calculation from Purdue and other economists to really understand what the different scenarios are. Because you could do something you think is great today, and when the climate, the financial climate is different, could have an adverse effect.
And again, I don't think that anyone's come up with the perfect solution here. Is there a perfect solution? Even as just we talk about property taxes on the whole, you've got a new lieutenant governor here who has, you know, come on this program and said, I think they're unconstitutional, but we can't just get rid of them because this is the system that we have. There's got to be some give and take here on the whole. We've got to figure out what is the solution to getting rid of them completely. Now, I'm not asking you to respond to that about the constitutionality of property taxes, but I think that there's a much larger conversation at play here of what is the best solution on taxation on the whole of how we do this for farmland owners. What's the best solution for homeowners? I mean, there's just a much larger conversation here on the whole, and yeah, farmland owners fit into this piece. So yeah, is there a permanent fix to the formula? Do we even need a formula? I mean, there has to be some answers. It's just, are we asking the right questions?
That's part of the issue with the tax structure we have. With property taxes, as you know, unless it's a cut, it's usually a shift. So if we say we're going to give farmers relief, well, then that relief gets shifted to all the other taxpayers, whether it's apartment owners or homeowners or businesses. And again, if you say homeowners, you need relief, then farmers are going to pick up. And if you have personal property, you're going to pay more. The only way to really get away with that or get away from that is totally elimination of property taxes. Actually, Representative J.D. Prescott from Randolph County has a bill. I don't believe it's going to get a hearing, but it would be a phase out of property taxes. Well, again, that's how you fund local government, local law enforcement, local schools, libraries. And so you have to have a replacement. His suggestion was a sales tax, increased sales tax to do that. That has pluses and minuses too, where he would tax all services. Everything but medical that's not already taxed would be taxed. Well, you know, that sounds good and it may work on paper, but when you really get to seeing what it is, and if you don't have any exemptions, you know, would a farmer actually be paying more under that scenario or system than what we are now? Those are the things that you really have to study and dig into. It's like eliminate a business personal property tax. That's an issue that's been come up many times. And if you're in a county that has large electric generation, then there's a lot of business personal property paid by those energy companies. And that's so if they get the relief, that means all the other taxpayers that are there are going to have to pay more to make up for that big corporation. So there's a lot of unintended consequences that can happen if you really don't do your homework and think through that. So would I like to do something different than property tax in Indiana? Yes, absolutely. I've said this before. If we didn't have property taxes, you could do away with two county offices. You wouldn't need an assessor, because an assessor, all they do is try to determine the value of your property so it can be taxed, and then the county treasurer collects those property taxes twice a year. Do I think we'll ever get away from that? Probably not.
I say sometimes it's difficult to talk to you, Kendall. I got to tell you. I consider you a friend, but it's hard to talk to you sometimes, and it's because I need to put different hats on you. Farmer Kendall Culp, Representative Kendall Culp, and then Farm Bureau Vice President Kendall Culp. And for the moment here, I want to, you know, just kind of remind folks as we have this conversation, Farm Bureau Vice President Kendall Culp, I think, you know, in your policy book, like, you guys are not opposed to taxes. Like, a big part of what you guys strive for is a thriving rural community, and part of that is making sure that there are taxes out there to, you know, make sure that police, fire, and all of these other services that are required to make sure that a rural community is thriving. So these conversations are going hand in hand to make sure that all of those things are happening. So it's a difficult, I guess, thing to kind of weigh in each hand here.
Well, actually, Farm Bureau policy supports income tax. You know, there are those that wanted to eliminate Indiana income tax, but Farm Bureau members see that if you're paying income tax, that's a larger base of taxpayers than just property owners. So more people would be paying in, and not just those that like I said, that own property. And so, and there are taxes you can adopt that would help offset property taxes, and those would be another income tax. So, yeah, farmers aren't, we just don't want to pay any taxes. They're kind of specific on what taxes they'd like to pay and what they really don't want to pay. But again, the fairest way is to have a larger base of people paying some tax than a few paying a lot more. And as I've told legislators this, I told them on my testimony in 1192, these rural counties, and you have to realize, you know, we have some really large, and I have one, rural districts that we represent, a lot of agriculture in them. But there's a lot of districts that don't have a lot of ag, that are suburban districts or even urban districts. And they don't understand really as much the needs we have in rural Indiana. But as I've told them, is agriculture cannot bear the brunt in these rural communities to provide all the services through their taxes. We have to spread the base. We have to enlarge the base. And that means we can't say no to every new development that comes into a community. And I know that may not be popular in some communities, but really when you're saying no, then what you're saying is I'm okay if my existing taxpayers pay more. Because instead of sharing the burden with a new taxpayer, you know, everybody wants a salary increase, everything's getting higher, the cost of services, the cost of emergency responders is going up, then someone has to pay that price.
And it's just, it's mind-boggling to me that people don't understand that farmers, I mean, why should farmers have to take on that additional cost simply because your profession requires you to own more land than the rest of us. I mean, that's simply what it is. Your profession requires you to own this land. My job doesn't. I get to do mine from a little tiny studio in my basement. You've got to own hundreds to thousands of acres to do what you do. And oh, by the way, feed us in the process.
And that's true. And
it's like you're being penalized for that.
And again, there's, you know, you've got to have more people paying the tax. And because if you're just relying in a rural agriculture community, I mean, you have a school that wants to expand. So there's a referendum. Well, in a lot of these cases, they get voted down. I mean, they like their school, but that means that the burden goes going to go on that one group of taxpayers again. And that's, unfortunately, they're like, we've had enough. And so then they push back on that. You see in a lot of communities where developments want to come in, and you know, local officials will put a moratorium on because they want to work on an ordinance or whatever, or they just don't want the development at all. And in our county, when Jasper County, when I was a county commissioner, the first one of those that came was a hog farm. It was a confined feeding operation. And they came in and the neighbors didn't want that, the close by neighbors. And they said, well, you need a moratorium. Well, we weren't going to do that. I mean, we're the number one dairy county in Indiana. We're certainly not going to put a moratorium on confined feeding operations. Then it was wind, and then it was solar. And then I took this position, but then the new commissioners dealt with CO2. And so there's always going to be another issue come along. And I know I'm divesting a little bit, but it's really important for these rural communities to know what they want their community to look like 20 years from now, and to start planning and making decisions today. Because one thing these rural communities have in common is they're losing population, which means you have less people paying taxes, less people working, less workforce. Schools are getting smaller. Local businesses are having a hard time filling positions that are usually filled by teenagers. And so it begins a spiral. And really the work starts today to try to keep your community so it's sustainable, so it's not spiraling downward in 20 years.
As we get back to, as we talk about the issue, but as we get back to your bill, House Bill 1192, redoing the formula, redoing the math on this, what's your sense as to what happens to it as we go throughout the session? A long way to go in this session. We're it's a long budget session. We're going into April on this thing, so a long way to go. But what's your sense right now of what happens to this bill and what happens to the property tax situation here as we go forward?
Well, that bill is probably going to lose its individual identity. Again, that bill was heard in Ways and Means, and the chairman said, I'm 99% sure you'll see this language again, but it's going to be in another bill. And I'm certainly fine with that. So as he puts together this big property tax reform package, that gives me hope agriculture is going to be addressed. And Representative Thompson is very understanding and aware of the concerns in agriculture in the rural communities, that he will insert that. And then when it goes to the Senate, of course, our work starts over again, right? We have to continue to advocate, talk to senators. You know, Representative Thompson will talk to his Senate colleagues over there in tax and fiscal and appropriations to try to make sure that continues to go forward, because there's so many stops along the way of a legislative journey of a bill that something could be tripped up or pulled out along the way, and you've really got to stay on top of it to make sure that it's still in there.
You mentioned at the beginning that, you know, on the campaign trail and everything, Governor Braun he has mentioned farmers throughout this property tax process. Has he talked with you about this bill specifically? Has that been brought up? Is he in support of something like this for farmers?
So I have been in contact with his staff directly, really all the way through the campaign. He was Senator Braun, and so his DC staff had good rapport with them. You know, some of his top staffers in DC, certainly his top three, have come back, and they're now on the governor's staff in Indiana. So part of Governor Braun's opportunities plan that is Freedom and Opportunities plan that he's laid out has really detailed property tax information in it that Indiana Farm Bureau has been supportive and was in his ear on that. This specifically, his staff called me to make sure that we had a placeholder to fix the farmland formula. And I said, well, I've got a spot for that. So I introduced that. They didn't tell me what they want to introduce. They just said, you know, you understand the situation, try to get something in. And so I would say that he and his staff have been excellent listeners. And when he's developed these stances on issues and laid out this whole really program of work that he wants to accomplish, a lot of the things that we've been talking with them for the last year are in that document. And so that gives me really great hope to know that we have now the new administration is behind some of the concerns that agriculture is facing. They support those. And again, just because they're supporting doesn't mean it's going to go through. But boy, that's a great first step.
Governor Braun had his State of the State address on Wednesday and addressed farmers in that State of the State and discussed one of the bills that Representative Kendall Culp has put forward. And we're going to hear some of that from Governor Braun and talk about one of those bills coming up here after the break. You're listening to the Indiana Ag Policy Podcast, presented by the Indiana Corn Growers Association, Indiana Soybean Alliance, with support from Indiana Farm Bureau.
There is strength in numbers. That's why the Indiana Soybean Alliance membership and policy and Indiana Corn Growers Association need you. These organizations represent Indiana soybean and corn farmers on critical and regulatory issues affecting their industry. Along with support from the national organizations, National Corn Growers Association and American Soybean Association, the Indiana members help determine public policy positions on critical issues, including farm bills, trade policy, and ethanol and biodiesel legislation. Become a member of Indiana Soybean Alliance membership, Indiana Corn Growers Association, or both. Visit incornandsoy.org to select a membership. That's incornandsoy.org.
At Indiana Farm Bureau, we serve tree farmers, goat farmers, and in fact, all farmers. With over 250,000 members, Indiana Farm Bureau represents a broad range of farmers and puts power in your collective voice. You also get advice from our subject matter experts, more affordable health plan options, and support for youth programs statewide. So whether you grow soybeans or strawberries, membership means you'll be heard. Become a member today at infb.org.
For farmers, and so many of us are in agricultural communities, let's create a taxed advantage farm savings account to help stabilize their income during bad crop years. And let's address our aging ag workforce with a tax credit for retiring farmers passing their farms on to the next generation. They need that help.
And that's Governor Braun at the State of the State address on Wednesday evening talking about farmers. One of these is introduced in a bill from Representative Kendall Culp, who joins us here on the Indiana Ag Policy Podcast, a tax credit for retiring farmers passing their farms on to the next generation. And that is HB 1191. And Kendall, let's talk about this bill. This is something that I feel like you and I have been actually talking about for quite some time. I know that this was something that was kind of near and dear to you. This is something that, we talked about even when we were talking about the farmland report that you asked for from ISDA and legislation in previous legislative sessions. We are losing farmland. It's going. We're losing this, and it's not coming back. God only put so much dirt here, and the more we lose, it's not coming back. And this is a way, I guess it's an option, right? This is a way to get some farmland into the hands of new farmers that want to keep farming.
Absolutely. So House Bill 1191, as you said, provides a tax credit to retiring farmers as long as they hook up with a younger beginning farmer. Now we define that in a bill. So it's a farmer that has farmed for less than 10 years or has filed a Schedule F for less than 10 years. And so there's limitations on how old that farmer can be. And the retiring farmer has to be at least 60 years old to be able to take advantage of that. The total tax credit, if you would max it out per individual, would be $67,000 off your Indiana income tax. Now you think about that and why that's so important, and I think will be so attractive to a retiring farmer. As you know, if you're a grain farmer, normally you're selling last year's crop, collecting for it the next year, and then you're prepaying your inputs for the following year. So that last year, you've got a crop to sell with no input expenses. And so it's basically all income. And so that's why I think we see a lot of farmers continue on, or maybe much more gradually slow down. Plus, they have a whole line of equipment and machinery to sell at the end of that time. And so many times today, there is no next generation coming back to the family farm per se. Maybe there's no children that want to farm, or they've moved away, or whatever the case may be. And as I've shared with the members of the committee, that's different in agriculture, because by and large, farmers, when they retire, they don't sell their farm. They continue to keep that farm. It produces income for them, and it gets bequeathed to their children at the time of their death. Now, the children may keep it and continue to honor, then they may sell it. If you're a business owner, when you retire from your business, if there's nobody behind you, many times you sell your business because it's an operating business and you cash in at that point in time. Farmers, it's a different scenario. So that's the family part. Someone asked me you surely wouldn't allow the tax credit to go to a child of the same family. I said, absolutely. We don't want to discriminate and give them an incentive to sell or lease your farm to someone that's not a family member if you have a family that wants to farm. So if you sell or lease your farm to a young beginning farmer, you're eligible for this tax credit. If it's a cash rent arrangement, you get so many dollars or percentage of the cash rent as the credit. If it's a grain share, crop share, then you get a percentage of the price of that crop to go for that. If it's strictly a livestock operation, then you get so many dollars per head of, if it's swine, for example, a swine produced, all counts towards that $67,000 maximum. That's per, we've capped that at $1 million. So the total liability to Indiana, the state of Indiana, or the budget would be $1 million. This is really patterned after the Pennsylvania law. Minnesota has a law. Iowa has a pretty good law on that. So we've done the research. We've looked at those, and we want to move forward with this. I took that to Senator Braun's staff back, 9 months ago, probably. They saw the value in that. And not only did they put the funding in the budget, they put the text of the bill in the budget. So if the budget bill passes, then this bill is going to be embedded in it, and it will pass and it will become official. You know, it's easy to get a program established with no funding. The funding, you don't have a program in this case without the funding. So Governor Braun and his staff have put that together, have embedded it in the budget bill, and I can't be any more excited about that.
And again, this is something that you've talked about for years now. I feel like you and I have discussed this, and it's because it's hard to get started as a new farmer, because unless you are a child of a farmer that might be retiring soon, it's kind of tough to get in. And again, if you are a retiring farmer and you don't have a child that wants to get in it, what are the options? But this, again, this is just another option. And I think the last time that you were on the podcast, I talked about the two songs that are on country radio right now that, you know, oh, this is my dirt. I'm not going to give it up. But when is the song coming out? You know, and I still haven't written it. I'm waiting. This is going to be the next big hit of what the actual reality is.
Yeah,
I
can't wait to hear it.
I mean, the developer comes through with the big check and is like, well, this is my retirement. That's more the reality. And you can't blame farmers for doing that. But this is another option, and it seems like a good one.
Yeah, it's another tool. You know, 95% of the farms in Indiana are family farms. Now, we're not talking about size because they look all different. So there's that opportunity. So, you know, everybody wants to feel good about a family farm. But what's disappointing is we just have less and less young farmers entering the agriculture. And so this gives them an opportunity of a little bit of a way in that wasn't there before. That to continue, not only to continue the heritage, continue the family farm, but could continue that economic activity. That is the driver in these small rural communities is agriculture. And, you know, a few years ago, Lieutenant Governor Elsperman, she talked about her dad had a jewelry store in Ferdinand where she grew up. And she said, I always knew what the economy in the agriculture community was because I sold more jewelry when it was high versus when it wasn't. You think about the product that he sold is a luxury item, right? Her parents sold. And so when it was good, farmers were spending more money and they like to spend money in their community. So I'm just hopeful that this continues to go on. We're going to keep encouraging it. If it's the case, it will become effective July the 1st. If the dollars are appropriated, then that program will get started. That will be really conducted through the State Department of Agriculture. That's where you would make application. If you're a retiring farmer, you would kind of get certified and qualified by contacting the State Department of Ag. And then you find your young farmer, whether it's a family member, a neighbor, someone in your community, someone that's qualified, you get matched up, and then you're eligible for that tax credit.
And there are so many programs out there through the Farm Credit System, through USDA. I mean, all sorts of different places for young farmers to get help to really get moving on some of these things too.
Absolutely.
And are there opportunities maybe forthcoming for the state to help with that?
Well,
maybe
everything is kind of on the table at this point. But like I said, you take small bites, one piece at a time. And so that's my goal this year is to get the program started and funded, at least for the first year.
All right. All right, young farmers. I'm trying to prime them there for you. I was trying to get them going. I like this program. Obviously, Governor Braun likes it. He mentioned it in the state of the state. And I think, you know, we had this conversation before when, you know, some people look at farmland and they're like, oh man, we could really put more businesses right there. Well, it already is a business. there already is a business there. Just farmers think that way. Maybe the general public, they don't. But let's get more people thinking that way.
Well, exactly. That's a concern is if you're driving down the interstate and you see all this bare farmland, it may be in crops, maybe it's already harvested, maybe you're tilling it or getting ready for planting. You know, you need to look at that as, boy, I'm growing food. This is a farmer, excuse me, who's a businessman and he's growing food and he's continuing to develop his farm for its best use. And that's for agriculture. That's to grow food. And whether that's improving it through drainage or soil health or fertility, there's a lot of ways that you can invest, and we're seeing those investments made today in agriculture because there is really so much competition for farmland. Then a lot of farmers are saying, okay, I'm not able to compete with cash rent. I'm not able to pay the big dollar, so I'm going to invest in my own land and make it more productive. And I think that's what a lot of them are doing. You have a much more valuable than piece of property to pass on to the next generation. Yeah.
I did want to ask about the other part of Governor Braun's comment during the State of the State where he says, for farmers, let's create tax-advantaged farm savings accounts to help stabilize their income during bad crop years. This is not one of your bills. This is not in any legislation that you're carrying or any other legislation that I'm aware of. Do you know what it is he's referring to here, Kendall?
So think of that as a similar to a health savings account,
mm-hmm.
where when commodity prices are good or profitability on the farm is good, then you could look at that as a retirement account, like an IRA, for example, or 401k. You put money in that account and it stays in that account. And then when you get a time where maybe in 2 years the ag economy's down, you're able to pull that money out. So it helps with your cash flow. This has been around, this concept. It was actually Senator Lugar's concept many farm bills ago, where he tried to get that enacted and never got it across the finish line. So then Senator Braun saw that, researched that, picked that up, and wanted to run with it. Now that he's Governor Braun, wants to get that instituted here in Indiana. That also is part of the budget that he submitted.
Well, we'll look forward to hearing more from him about that. Let's look into more of the bills that you have. I know that this is another bill that Governor Braun talked a lot about, and you're carrying the Ag Online Portal. This sounds to me a lot like what USDA put out, a farmers.gov at the federal level. Sounds like it's something that he wants here at the state level, and it sounds like all good news to me.
Well, that's exactly right. And this is kind of unique on this, because when we had the Land Use Task Force back in 2023, and we met three times that summer, that was one of the things that came out of the recommendation, to really have one-stop shopping for farmers and rural communities to look for grants, funding opportunities, programs, to find out where regulations and laws were at that would affect you, and to get those all in one place. And so I had began preparing a bill to do that when, again, Governor Braun came out with his suggestion. He was very familiar with farmers.gov at the federal level, and they were asking about putting this in, again, their Freedom and Opportunity Act. And I said, well, I'm already working on a bill. So they said, well, why don't you carry it for us? Mine was for state and local funding opportunities. They wanted to add federal into that. We're not sure. There could be 92 different local different funding opportunities. So we're really focusing on state and federal. They also wanted to have feedback. So if there is a proposed rule, say a federal rule, and there's a comment period, that you will be able to comment through that portal, because it will link up to that site. Also, they wanted to make sure there was opportunity for feedback for how user-friendly that portal would be. And that's going to be part of that. That was a Governor Braun initiative as well. So we've put all that together with one more thing. Again, this bill it passed out of the Ag Committee. It passed on second readings this week. It'll be eligible next week for final passage out of the House, and then we'll send it over to the Senate. And so as you referenced earlier, the inventory of lost farmland, that data was released July 1st of this year. One of the recommendations from Indiana State Department of Agriculture was to do that every 5 years. We've got the foundation. We've got the base now. Let's keep it updated. We'll do that every 5 years after the Census of Agriculture. And so that language was in this bill, too, to make sure that that is statute. Now, Governor Braun could tell his State Department of Ag to do that. While he's governor, that's fine. But will the next governor do it? We get it in statute, and then we'll make sure that happens each time.
And I know that Director Don Lamb thinks that's a good idea as well. But again, yes, when he's not director anymore, I think that that's a great idea as well. Going through the list here, taxation of grain processing equipment. You and I talked about this one very early on this year. Tell us about that one.
So I'm excited. I'm excited for that one as well. I'm not sure of the fate. We're gonna break that into a couple different parts as we move forward, I think, to make sure that we get it, that we get that heard. So there is a real concern out in the countryside about a lack of delivery points for grain. These country elevators are diminishing, or they're still dotting the landscape, but they're just closed down, especially if it's concrete. If it's a concrete facility, most of those were probably built in the 60s, maybe the 50s. There's more liability there. And so there's a concern. They have a hard time getting those insured. I live 2 miles from one, 2 million bushel storage, and they were shut down this year. They shut down actually last year during harvest. So what this bill does, it does a couple things. It it looks to farmers who are now going to be required to build on farm, more on-farm storage. So that investment, say that was a co-op elevator. So instead of the co-op owning it, all of that cost is being transferred to the individual farmer. Now, granted, they have the asset too, but they have to lay out all the cash to build that storage. I'm saying they would get an 100% exemption if they build any kind of grain handling, drying, or storage facilities on their farms. They put up a new grain leg, they build a grain bin, they convert over, they buy an auger. That would all be exempted from taxation, 100% exemption on that for the life of the asset. Now, I went to my county assessor because I was just thinking we would do that with any new construction. And so she took Jasper County and she came back and she said, I've looked at the assessed value of all the grain storage facility owned by farmers in Jasper County, and it's only $15 million. She said, now that's probably very undervalued, but she said, it not sure it's worth it for an assessor to have to separate out the new and the old and do the paperwork. She said, if you're going to do it, why don't you just exempt all of it? And I was pretty quick to say, that sounds like a good idea to me. And so we do that. And so I don't want it just to be on the farm. I want to encourage these grain facilities that are in operation, the commercial ones now, to expand and to add more storage. So they would get a 10-year exemption for any new capacity they put, again, grain handling, a way to handle more grain. You think about that as we move farther and farther away, you could easily travel 25 miles to deliver grain. And that just slows your harvest down. Or if you're a part-time farmer, you farm on the weekends, maybe you don't own a semi and you just have a few hours on the weekend, you just physically don't have time to do that. So why should that force you to rent your farm to someone else? So I'm really excited about this piece of legislation. The exemption from the the locals have a play in this, and so does the state. So it clarifies some language that I passed 2 years ago, that there would be all of that equipment would be Indiana sales tax exempt totally. Now you think, well, it already is. Well, a grain bin, a storage grain bin just for storage, technically can be assessed a sales tax. So we're going to clear that up. Any confusion, it's 100% exempt. On the county level, then, like I said, it would be 100% exemption off your personal property tax. So the county has a hand in it. The state has a hand. They're both giving up a little bit of dollars to help encourage that investment on the farm.
And you mentioned this is becoming a very serious issue of where to take this grain, because they are dropping like flies. I mean, it really is. You mentioned they're tough to get insured. I think that just a lot of the issues that they're having, if they have structural issues, it's cost prohibitive to try to fix, in some cases, try to expand. I mean, it's becoming a major issue, and I've heard from many farmers that this is tough right now. And you know, maybe having some of these tax exemptions will help with some of the on-farm storage that folks desperately need. If you drive around in Tippecanoe County here, you'll see several of the bags just laying in fields that's what they were forced to use this year because there's nowhere else to take it.
Yeah, I talked to one Tippecanoe County farmer, and he partnered with another neighbor to buy a bagging unit, and he said it was like 7 cents a bushel is what it costs for the hardware and the bag and all that. And it's not like that's what he wanted to do, but that really was his only option if he wanted to get harvest done. And you think about how quick harvest was this fall. I know from start to finish in our corn harvest, we had zero rainout days. I mean, it was just, once you go, we went. And in our case, we had enough storage between what we had sold at a commercial site and our own storage. But that's not the case for everyone, and it really makes it more difficult. So, yeah, I'm hopeful we can get a hearing on this and really get this bill finished.
Kendall, again, you've got a boatload of bills here, and they all impact agriculture. What other ones are important to you that we should discuss here? I know that, you know, I think that at some point here, we're probably going to have to spend an entire podcast on the grain indemnity bill. That's just kind of its own thing. And I know that there have been issues surrounding all of that up north after lawsuits and things. We'll spend some time on that one on another podcast, I think. And there were so many hands in trying to get that bill put together. So that one probably deserves its own podcast here at some point. But what other bills that you have are kind of near and dear to you at this point that you hope to see really get the push through that they need?
Well, let me highlight two for you. So House Bill 1250 is one that helps protect prime farmland. I hear a lot about from constituents about protecting prime farmland. It's being developed for other uses other than agriculture. That's problematic. I hear that a lot from non-farmers, from the non-agriculture community that drive up and down the road that are used to seeing cornfields and bean fields in their communities, and now they're seeing some other use and they're not seeing that crop planted. And they're concerned that we're not going to have enough food. Now, that's not a concern of mine. We're very productive. Our farmers are very efficient. Use of technology, bioengineered seeds, that's not an issue. But for a lot of the non-farm public, that is. So to try to address that, I suggested a 15% assessed value reduction in your farmland base rate if you meet the qualifications of prime farmland. So that would be a productivity factor of 1.0 or a higher, or class 1, 2, 3, or 4 farmland. The NRCS has all that data. There's, I think, 6 or 7 farmland classifications. You can go as high as 1.27, I believe, the productivity factor, all the way down to, 0.7. So it's a big variation. Now, others have said, well, why don't you try to protect all farmland? Well, again, it's a cost, right? And so if you're taking assessed value away in a county from farmland and you're a small rural county, there's not a lot of other ways to make that up. So you have to be realistic about that. So that's one. The other bill is 1602. It has not been heard yet, but it's scheduled to be heard in the House Ag Committee next week. And it's my local foods bill. And I'm really excited about that. There's 5 parts of that bill. It's pretty comprehensive. There is a fiscal on it, which means it would go to Ways and Means. So we're running out of time, really, to get bills to Ways and Means for them to get heard and to get out because they're working on the budget. So we may have to amend that bill a little bit. Number one, it finds some money for Indiana Grown. I'm a big supporter of Indiana Grown. It has a lot of members, of course, all from Indiana that produce a food product. And so it creates a grant program where there would be 100 grants of up to $2,500 to encourage the production or the sale or the consumption of locally grown food. So if you're a restaurant and you purchase food from another Indiana Grown member, so anywhere in the state, at least 25% of your food is locally sourced, then you can get a 25% deduction on your property tax, whether personal property or real property. I think that's a pretty good incentive. So that part is what I would call the local food ready community. That's the benefit of that. If a county council adopts the ordinance that says we want to support local foods, then if you're selling that in your retail establishment, that's the incentive you get to buy local or to sell local, to buy from a local provider and then sell that. So that's really important. The Indiana Grown piece is part of that. There's a labeling part to that. Now, Representative Baird had his own standalone labeling bill. He was concerned about cultivated meats, minor alternative meats such as cell-based or plant-based meats. Iowa had a very strict bill, and mine patterns the Iowa bill. Representative Baird's pattern the Arizona bill. It says it would have to be labeled saying this is an imitation meat product. That has to be done in retail establishments. Again, I think. Consumers need to know what they're buying. And I mean, there's no animal protein. There's actually insect protein in some of this lab grown meat. Yeah. So that's a concern. So that labeling aspect is part of that as well. The fourth part is this was brought to me by a constituent. There was a concern if there is no appeal process to a local health food inspector their determination. So if you have a restaurant and they come in and they make a determination, they said, no, that's not what the statute says, they get the final word. This just gives you an appeal process to the local legislative body, which would be the county commissioner, for them to hear your case. And then the fifth part is really another important piece. And it allows meat, frozen meat, to be sold to the end consumer by the package instead of by the whole or the half. So right now, if you go to a state inspected facility and I sell my neighbor a hog, that does not have to have the Indiana Board of Animal Health stamp. It's a state inspected facility, but since it's for your own consumption, it doesn't have to be the state inspected seal. But if you take that and you sell a package to that same neighbor under the current law, that has to have a stamp. So what my bill says, you know, maybe you don't have this freezer space for a whole hog, or maybe you can't afford to lay the dollars out for a half a beef all at one time. I just want 10 packages of hamburger, for example. As long as it's raised by the seller and it's packaged and frozen and labeled when it was packaged, and the weight and the product and the address of the producer, then that would have the same, it's called custom exempt status, as a whole beef would, or a whole hog. So those are the five parts of the food bill. It's fairly comprehensive. I had a lot of thoughts and I put them all into one bill, but I'm pretty excited to think, you know, there's a lot of people that really are particular about their food. Some people can afford to have a specialty kind of foods. Other people just look for the cheapest food. Whatever you do is fine. But for those that want to really know that their food's grown locally and know who's growing their food, we're going to put some incentives in the law that kind of helps that.
What a great program in Indiana Grown. It was one of the, when I started with Hoosier Ag Today, 7 years ago, 2 weeks ago, it was one of the first things that I went to was an Indiana Grown event, and it was just Indiana Grown products everywhere. I think, I don't know how much popcorn I had that day, but man, oh man. It's going to be tough with some of the budget cuts that have been proposed through ISDA and other state agencies. The Indiana Grown program, people should know, with all of its growth over the years, it's a relatively new program, and they've seen such tremendous growth. That program is run by like three people.
Yeah, that's right.
It's really quite incredible what Caroline Patrick and her team of, again, three people, including her, what they do. I'm all for any money that they can get to really grow that program even more, because it is fantastic. Seeing that Indiana Grown, seal of approval on things at the grocery store is fantastic.
It is, absolutely.
Kendall, this has been amazing. Again, all of these bills, it seems like, you know, we go a year ago at the State House and there just wasn't a whole lot going on in the way of agriculture. And now this year, boom, it explodes. We're just seeing all sorts of things. And yeah, I know it's a budget year, but it just seems like everything for agriculture is happening down at the State House this year. And we appreciate you stopping by and filling us in on everything going on in the way of agriculture down in Indianapolis. So thank you very much for stopping by and thank you for what you're doing. I mean, again, that's quite a list you've got there.
Well, it's kind of interesting because I don't intentionally just focus on agriculture issues. It is very important to my district. Last year, I had four bills that were passed, and they all went to four different committees. Only one went to ag. That was the foreign ownership bill. Mm-hmm. And so it was very diversified. This year, you know, I tried to look at our land use task force recommendations, and most of those just came to ag. So we'll take them as they come, and we'll do the best we can with them.
Yeah, there are so many bills flowing through the State House this year, in this budget year. But ag is a big component, and there's a lot of conversation about agriculture at the State House. So keep listening to this podcast. We'll keep telling you all about it. So, Kendall, thank you. Really appreciate the time.
My pleasure.
And we'll do it again here very soon. We'll talk more ag policy here on the Ag Policy Podcast, presented by the Indiana Corn Growers Association, the Indiana Soybean Alliance, and Indiana Farm Bureau.